Hello, and welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy, the podcast where we have conversations with musicians, music producers, publicists, live promoters, zine makers, journalists, and more about their experiences working in the music industry as women, non-binary, and queer people. I'm your host, Isabel Korp, the founder of the queer femme music-based blog and YouTube channel, A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Today, I am joined by Grammy-winning, Diamond-certified songwriter DeLacy, who is here to talk about her latest album, The Girl Has a Dream, an unfiltered journey through her innermost thoughts, desires, dreams, and insecurities. DeLacy and I discuss her retreat in upstate New York during the pandemic that led to the making of this album, in addition to our favorite comfort records, and our personal hot takes on popular films and method acting. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode. To start out, you can start by telling me your name, what time it is, and where you are for archival purposes.
Okay. I'm DeLacy. It's 10:37, and I'm actually in like the most random area of California that I don't even know what it is. I'm in my car.
Random parts of California. I guess that's the best place to be drifting in throughout your day.
Yeah, it's like really random. I was driving back like from Palm Springs, although I'm going to Santa Barbara, so I'm like, I don't know where I am that I've stopped, but somewhere really ugly and random.
That's funny. I remember, I think maybe I was driving away from New York one time with my mom. Uh-huh. And the GPS took us to this like really odd, like no man's land, like fairy-ish spot like that. It gave like Red Hook / Staten Island vibes, but yeah, it was neither of those places. And my mom was like, I've never been to this area in my entire life.
Yeah, I've definitely never been to wherever I am right now. It's really random.
So I guess to start out, you can tell me a little about yourself. Where do you come from? What do you do? And what brings us to where we are today with DeLacy?
Well, that's like a loaded question, but I guess I make music. I live in Los Angeles. I'm from Orange County, California. I'm a beach girl. But yeah, I guess music is what brought me to this and what always brings me to everything I ever do, I feel like.
Nice. And you still live in Orange County now?
No, actually, I live in Los Angeles.
Where in LA?
I'm like on the east side. I'm like in Atwater Village, if you know where that is, like right by Silver Lake. Everyone knows Silver Lake, no? I feel like it's like one place I can.
Silver Lake is such an elegant name, too. For a town name.
Yeah, I never even really thought about it, actually. It's really funny. I don't know why it's called that either. There's like a man-made reservoir, but there's no lakes.
That's actually kind of hilarious. So you spent a majority of the pandemic, from what I understand, in upstate New York. What drew you to the rural pastures of that land? Like, what sort of circumstances?
Yeah, well, actually, I only spent the amount of time that I made my album up there, actually. The pandemic, I spent, like, in my small condo, claustrophobically trying to make music. So I wanted to escape, and I wanted to be somewhere with more, like, space, and it was, like, really high COVID when I went there, and it just felt like I wanted to go somewhere where I could have, you know, just feel safe to like walk around outside and have my own like area. And also my best friend who I make all my music with was based in Brooklyn at the time. And, you know, I knew that was kind of like an easy destination for him to get to. It sounded beautiful to me. I've always wanted to go up there. It was my first time. And so like I found an Airbnb up there. It's like a cozy cabin in the woods on like, we had our own little lake and everything. We had no neighbors. So it felt really like safe to be up there. This is when everyone was like really scared still of, you know, COVID. And so that's kind of how I ended up in Hunter. It was just kind of like, you know, it worked out. It's closer to him. And it also looked beautiful. And I had never been there. It was also like I wanted to be somewhere where I saw the leaves change colors because it was going to be the fall. And in California, we have no seasons at all.
Yeah. How do you feel like being on the East Coast affected your mindset and what you were doing?
I mean, the East Coast is where I've made almost all my music as an artist, which is funny. So I'm always really inspired when I'm on the East Coast. And I think that's maybe why I always like kind of tend to gravitate towards going out there. I wrote my first album in New York City when I was living out there. So yeah, I don't know. The East Coast is a special place for me, even though I'm a West Coast girl.
Yeah. And do you want to tell me a little bit more about this friend and the working relationship that you two have?
Sure, yeah. He's actually like one of the people when I first started out in the music industry, I was only like 21 when I signed a publishing deal, and he was one of my first like co-writing sessions ever, which was terrifying to me because I had never done that growing up. I mean, I just wrote by myself in my bedroom. And I don't know, he's just always been one of my favorite collaborators. And it's kind of like my longest working relationship too, which is funny. But we have a really funny dynamic too. We're like brother and sister. We like fight and then we're totally fine. And we just yell at each other when we're making music. But we both are like really, we let each other be crazy and make weird shit all the time. So it really works out for us. We love making music together.
That's really awesome. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Elton and Bernie almost.
That's cool. I mean, that's a compliment.
Yeah, but it's like, it's really nice to have like that working relationship with another creative that's like lasted for like years.
Totally. It's really rare, I feel like. Yeah.
Yeah. You said you met when you were like 21.
Yeah, I'm kind of forgetting. I guess I was probably like 21, 22 when I first worked with him. Yeah, it's been a long time.
That's amazing. To go a little in the direction of your latest album, The Girl Has a Dream, what would you say was going through your mind when you were writing it? Like, what was happening in your life at the time that sort of affected the work?
Yeah. I don't know. Honestly, I feel like it was mostly inspired just by like, I get like the urge to make music every once in a while when I've like taken time away from writing. And, you know, I wrote my first album, Black Coffee, and it had been like, even though it had only come out like 3 months prior to me starting this next album, it in reality, I wrote it like, you know, 2 years prior. So it had been like 2 years since I had really dove in on, you know, making a body of work for myself, because I'm a professional songwriter for other people too. So I spend a lot of my off time, you know, doing that, which is also super fulfilling for me. But it's just a different itch that like I scratch when I like make music for myself. And it had been, you know, a couple of years, maybe it had been three, because I'm losing track of my life, especially during COVID times. But, you know, I just really, it's like whenever inspiration strikes for me is when I make music, I feel like. And I had, you know, I was kind of going through a lot of heartache of like my debut album came out literally the beginning of COVID, the shutdown, like literally the week of. So I was, you know, grappling with like a lot of personal stuff, but and you know, creative block. Like I was having such writer's block, I felt like, for a while, but I really just had the feeling of I needed to make another body of work. And I was also trying to, it was a weird time for like songwriters and musicians, because during the pandemic, we were all trying to make music over Zoom, which was so odd and so weird for me. I'm sure like you've experienced this, and I feel like so many people had to, you know, rethink their like business model in general of like how they did work, and Zoom like took over all of our lives. But as far as like making music over Zoom, it's psychotic. It's like, you're just, you can't move around. You're staring at your computer. You also, there's like lag time and you can't really hear what the other person's doing half the time. And you're trying to be inspired, but you're just staring at each other through a computer. It can be awkward if you don't know them. So I don't know. I was like also really sick of doing that and like couldn't do it anymore. So I really wanted to like go somewhere with someone in person and make music, which is why we kind of like holed up in that cabin for like a month and made a ton of music together.
Yeah, and also on top of that, you're, from what I understand, you're writing about really personal things. And
yeah, of course.
As someone who also writes for other people, how would you say that, you said that they're both fulfilling in different ways. How would you see, I mean, how would you say that this writing for yourself versus writing for other people, like what are the different itches that each of them scratches specifically?
I don't know. It's weird because I feel like I am really lyric driven in both ways. But when I'm writing with someone else, you know, it's like I feel like, you know, it's I'm trying to cater to what they're going through more than what I'm necessarily personally going through in the moment. But I mean, either way, I feel like I always pull from inspiration for myself. It's always really personal. Like in songwriting, at least the style that I do it, it's like very vulnerable regardless, even when I'm writing for other people. But it's just different when it's just me and my best friend. I'm not going into different rooms with different people every day. It's just me and Ido, or like me and the few other collaborators that I have on this upcoming album. And we just kind of, it's more just like a diary from, like, I usually have a, like, saved up ideas that I know are just like would only work for me because they're super personal or really situational, like to my life. And yeah, it's just a different, it's different, but it's like, I mean, it's equally fulfilling, but it is different. And it is more free for me personally.
Who are some collaborators you've worked with who you would count as a life achievement to have worked with?
Huh, that's interesting. I don't know. It's hard to say. Like, I feel like everyone, I'm proud of everything I've done. I guess like one of the biggest things for me, I mean, I didn't even get to work with her, but Alicia Keys, like who I have looked up to like my whole life since I was little, like put like one of her songs, she sang a hook of mine in one of her songs like that came out, and that was like a crazy life achievement for me. It feels like it was like a really crazy, like, if you would have told young DeLacy that, it would have been crazy to her.
Wow. Like, where did said hook come from?
Yeah, it's funny. It's, like, a really weird story, and it kind of feels full circle. It was, like, it was actually, like, the very first song that ever came out for me as a songwriter. It was called New York City. It's, like, my very first pop cut ever. And, like, literally fast forward 10 years, and I get a call to, like, someone wants to use your chorus and like sample it in this rap song. And I was like, sure, that's fine. Didn't like look into it. And like the day before it came out, they're like, oh my gosh, it's Alicia Keys and Kanye West and 504. And Alicia Keys is singing the hook, and she didn't change one lyric of my hook. And it was just like the craziest. It was really crazy, especially because I didn't really know about it beforehand. Cause I don't know. That was probably on me. Just get jaded, I guess.
That's really crazy. Like, what were you doing when you found out?
I don't remember. I think I was honestly driving, which is, like, not romantic at all.
Where do you remember, like, where you were driving at the time?
No. I think I was in Hollywood. I was, like, leaving a session, and my manager called me and told me.
That's insane. I remember, like, this is not, like, on the same level, but I remember talking to a really good friend / older mentor of mine, and she is really good friends with Shirley Manson from Garbage.
Oh, sick. Yeah.
And I had this friend on my podcast, and we just rambled for hours about how much we love Garbage, and then...
Yeah.
The next day she was like, I told Shirley about your pod. And I was like, no, you didn't. I have no idea. She just said, I told her about it, and I was like, what? I would just, like, the fact that, like, my name would ever come up in any conversation.
Yeah, totally, in a conversation.
Yeah, with anyone that I admire.
Honestly, my name probably didn't come up in conversation with her, but that's how it goes.
And what is one specific song that you wrote on this album that you feel like was the most difficult to bring full circle? Because I feel like a lot of really great songs often take like a lot of like labor or a really long time, at least from a lot of musicians that I've spoken to. Like, I'll be like, oh, this is my favorite song, and they'll be like, oh, really? That I was gonna scrap that one.
That's funny. Yeah, I definitely can relate to that. A lot of the time, I feel like my favorite song on the album was technically like the easiest and simplest, and I put like basically no technical labor into it at all compared to the other songs. But it was like, it had felt like I had waited my whole life and had to live my whole life to write it, if that makes sense. So it was like, so looking at it from that perspective, it was a lot of labor, I guess. It was, you know, I almost didn't put it on the album, actually, because it's a really long song, and it's just, like, 15 verses, basically, and it doesn't really have a typical structure at all of a typical song. But technically, the recording is just, like, basically a one take, maybe two takes, I can't remember, and I ended up just using the demo, because when I tried to, like, re-record it and fix the vocals and stuff, I hated it. I, like, didn't like how I kind of like felt like I lost the emotion behind it. So I ended up using like the original, just kind of crappy demo that I recorded under a blanket, literally, to like make the sound like a makeshift sound booth. But it's just me and my guitar. I didn't even get to mix it because I lost the original like files for it. So I couldn't get it mixed. So it's kind of like, it didn't take a lot of labor in the actual recording of it, since I used that version of it. But it was like a song that I feel like I needed to write so badly. And a part of me feels like a part of me feels like I just had been, my whole life was building up to writing this song. It's called Everything You Need to Know About Me Today. And it's literally like so long. I think it's 8 minutes, but I really love it. And it's my favorite one on the album.
That's awesome. I really love when songs that are that long can just pull the listener into such an immersive world.
Yeah, it's hard to do, but yeah, that is so awesome when it happens, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Do you I guess that piques my interest to ask another funny question. Like, do you have any specific songs that are like really long that you feel like are able to like remain compelling the entire runtime?
Yeah, I know that there are like multiple songs in my past that I like. I mean, I can't even think of a specific one, I don't think, right now, but it's like I've looked and I'll listen to an old album of something I like used to love, and I'll listen to it and I'll be like, oh, my favorite song. And I'll look at how long it is, and I never even noticed how long it was because it was, I didn't notice. I obviously wasn't bored during it. It was like 8 minutes and I still loved it. I feel like that happens to me more often than not. So I guess I don't have a problem with long songs generally.
Yeah, it's also really fun just to, like, because it's such a gamble, too, because it could either be, like, the most thrilling experience or, like, the biggest, like, slog.
Oh, yeah. But, and honestly, I worry. I've been kind of playing some secret little acoustic shows, and I end with that song. And I'm always, like, self-conscious halfway through. I'm like, is everyone really bored? Like, is this just, am I torturing the audience if this is really long?
Yeah,
I worry that it's like a slog, but I mean, everyone always comes up to me and points out that song, so it's cool. So far I've gotten good feedback, but I do worry about that, and that is so accurate. I've definitely experienced like songs that are just too long, and I'm like, they should have ended it right there.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is like a good example, because it's not all that long. It's only like 6 minutes, but
that's still long though, especially today's today's world where songs can be like 2 minutes, you know what I mean?
Right. Or like people's attention spans are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And exactly. So it's just like, no, they have to be 30 seconds now. But
yeah, totally.
But
eventually they'll be like 10-second songs.
But yeah, I went to Boston Calling a few weeks ago, and I went to the Green Stage like at 8 p.m. before Paramore was supposed to go on at 9 p.m. because I was like, oh, I have to make it to be able to like see Paramore to be even in the line of view. So I went to wait for Paramore. And then on the adjacent stage, Queens of the Stone Age was playing.
Yeah.
And they, and they're never, they're not like a band I would intentionally go out of my way to see, but they absolutely like destroyed. It was insane. I think it was after like a 5-year hiatus where they didn't perform.
Sick. Yeah, I've heard they're really amazing live.
But they ended with Song for the Dead, which is the song that Mark Lanegan sings on, rest in peace. But yeah, it's like a 6-minute song, and it has like 20 fake outs. Like, so I feel like that's like a really great example of like a really, really long song that's just like, that just keeps teasing the listener for sure.
Yeah, totally.
And when, I also read that you're a really big fan of Stevie Nicks, so I was wondering if you'd like to talk a little bit about your relationship to her and what she means to you personally as a creative and as a person.
Yeah, totally. She, you know, she's just one of the best songwriters, obviously, and I feel like I just knew that at a very young age. Like, I know that, like, Rumors was one of the first, like, vinyl records I ever heard when I was, like, probably 12 or 13 that my dad gave me. And I mean, her solo stuff, I just have always followed her career and looked up to her so much. I absolutely am like transcended when I hear her voice too. So she's, you know, I wish I had an actual relationship with her, but I have an imaginary one in my mind. And she's one of the best, you know. She's a big inspiration to me, of course.
Yeah, she just transcends space and time.
She's amazing.
And you, and growing up in Southern, like, California and stuff, what types of other records were you raised on?
I mean, it was funny. I was a kid who, like, felt like I was born in the wrong era and, like, would only listen to, like, old music. But I also was obsessed with music. So it's like, I really listened to everything. I had a huge palate, I feel like. I don't really know why. I just was obsessed with the craft of, like, song and respected it, like, no matter what kind of genre it was. I loved pop music still, but I, you know, of course I, like, listened to all the greats and, like, the oldies. Yeah, I don't know if, like, being in Southern California really, like, influenced what I listened to. I feel like I listened to so much different music.
Yeah. What is one album that, like, you put on and you feel like you're a child again? Like, one example for me, for instance, is the Cat Stevens record that I can't remember its name, the one that has Moonshadow on it, because my mom...
Yeah, Cat, that's great, yeah.
My mom used to sing a variation of that to me, like, her own version, where she would change the lyrics when I was a child to help me get to sleep, so, like...
That's cute.
So that's, like, an example. Like, what's one of those records for you?
You know, I feel like I have so much because I was really obsessed with music from such a young age. But yeah, I guess I would say probably like Billie Holiday or something. I mean, Elvis definitely takes me back because my grandma like was obsessed with Elvis and all she would play was Elvis from literally since I was born. So I would say something around there. I probably Elvis, honestly. When it's on, I get this crazy nostalgia.
I bet. Did you watch the Elvis biopic?
Yeah, I did. I was like reluctant to watch it, but I did.
Oh, what made you reluctant?
I was reluctant because, I mean, sometimes Baz Luhrmann is, like, kind of crazy, and I've definitely been a fan, and I've liked movies of his before, but also, I don't know, I was, like, really kind of just salty about, like, this isn't going to be accurate, and no one should be trying to be Elvis, like, I don't think they should be making an actor, they shouldn't have who's this Austin Butler guy? I'm skeptical because I'm like a diehard, you know?
Yeah.
But honestly, I was blown away. I thought it was amazing. And he was absolutely amazing. And I was ready to like hate it and criticize it, but it was really good.
I still haven't seen it, if you can believe it. Because I
should.
I have the same skepticism about Baz Luhrmann as well.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people do. I actually am a fan. So it was more, I think, like Elvis for me. I was like, no one should be playing Elvis. And also, I didn't like want to see someone trying to be him, if that makes sense. I don't know. It's like, it was like a sore subject for me. It was odd. But I really, really did love it. And I think they did a really good job. Like, it was accurate. And he killed it. He was amazing. I like didn't even, as a diehard Elvis fan, I didn't even notice right away that it wasn't Elvis's voice the whole time. Some of them were renditions, but a lot of it was Austin singing, and I was like, holy crap. Like, I was really blown away by that.
Yeah, I think he almost did too good, because now he can't stop talking.
I think
like
he's
him.
A little confused about his identity now. He like thinks he's all
poor guy. Yeah, did you see like those viral clips of him like an interview on the red carpet when the Carrie Diaries came out?
Bro, are you okay?
Versus like his Actors on Actors interview with Janelle Monáe, and then it's just like, dude, what happened to your voice?
Totally, it's crazy. But I mean, that does happen to actors when they get too involved in a character. It's like kind of it's scary.
The method acting,
an identity crisis.
Yeah, the method acting just doesn't wear off.
Yeah, I guess not.
And I hate method acting, by the way. Like, that is something I, like, totally despise.
Why? You just think it's, like, toxic or what?
I think it's toxic, yeah. It's just, like for example, like, Leo DiCaprio, like, when he was, like, was it Django Unchained, I think? Like, he just, like, fully just, like, got into that mindset. Because before he was, like, oh, no, I can't say a racial slur, I'm too... And then he just went to the opposite end of the spectrum. It's just, like, dude, you can...
I get what you're
there's
saying.
Levels to this.
It's, like, kind of... It's uncomfortable. It's
you don't
like,
have to become
scary.
The person on set and, like, treat your fellow co-stars like shit.
I think a lot of that has to do with, too, it's, like, it depends on who's the director. Because some directors, like... encourage like improvising and stuff, so they want you to like really be the person so that you can like kind of, you know, some not everything has to be totally on script. Like, I would be so bad at that. I couldn't do that. I also feel like I'm always on the verge of like losing my mind, so I can't imagine like forcing myself to like be somebody else. I think I would officially become like schizophrenic or something.
That's funny. Yeah.
I wouldn't come back from it.
Right, yeah. And sorry, this is New York, so someone
totally.
Ambulance is totally laying on that siren. And I guess my final question is, what does the rest of the year have in store for DeLacy?
That's a great question. I'm inspired to make more music again so far, so hopefully I'll be making more. I hope that I'll be like playing some live shows and I'll get to like connect with a real audience out there. Yeah, I'm hopefully just performing and more music. If inspiration keeps striking, you know? Never know.
Never know. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much once again for
joining
me.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And shout out to Josh for connecting us. Funny story, I actually reached out to him before I got the job that I have in artist marketing management, and just to interview like one of the Shorefire clients. And now we're working together on an artist release in a corporate setting, which is hilarious. All right. Well, once again, your album is phenomenal. And I was really out of it the day that you were doing that secret performance at the speakeasy, but next time I would love to pop by.
Great.
For sure.
Hopefully that will happen.
Yes.
Especially in New York, my favorite.
Well, thanks again, and I hope you have an amazing rest of your day.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you so much for listening to Sounding Out with Izzy, and thank you again to DeLacy for joining me. Remember to subscribe and sign up for the mailing list on my YouTube channel and written blog, both under the name A Girl's Two Sound Sense.
give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode of Sounding Out with Izzy.